is September 3, which I wrote down so I wouldn't forget it. This is Paul Rodell, the IVS Oral History Project, and I'm here tonight with Phil Scott in his home in Grand Ledge, Michigan. We just had dinner. We're watching the fire go down out on the back porch, listening to the sounds of the night. Phil was in Vietnam from 1967 through 69, coming at an interesting time as resignations were occurring, and then later during Tet Offensive, work down in the Delta.
I didn't work in the Delta.
I'm sorry, not in the Delta, but with CHOMs. With some CHOM
mainly
people.
Mainly Central.
Yeah, Central, coastal kind of folks.
Yeah.
And with the National Voluntary Service, a counterpart to IVS, but Vietnamese. I can't think of anything more for an introduction, so I'll leave that introduction. That's done.
Okay.
And actually start now, and starting the same way as we have with everyone else, to begin by asking you about things that were not in the survey form, simply because the survey form was only 4 pages. We wanted to make sure people would return it, you know, rather than giving them a book to write.
So could have written a book too.
Yeah, well, that's the danger, you know, or you know. But anyway, so something about yourself, where and when you were born, and who your parents were—not just their names, but who they were as people, for your family, community involvement, whatever, how they shaped you. But other influences on your life as you were growing up and the young Phil is forming until he decides to go into IVS, however that path takes him. And now I can shut up.
Oh.
Except to chirp in, like we said.
Well, that's a long path.
Yes, it is. This is the longest question for most people.
Well, to start at the beginning, I was born in January 2nd, 1945, at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas.
Oh, not a Michigander.
Not originally.
Mm-hmm.
My father returned from the war for a week or so, went back to Germany, or France, went back to France, and I was born in the interim.
Mm-hmm.
Moved to Michigan when I was 3 years old. And lived in the same house until I left for college. So I was basically in the same school system, same house, pretty consistent background. My father was a lieutenant colonel in the armed forces.
What branch?
Army. Adjutant General, I believe.
He
was a lawyer, obviously. His jobs were primarily, when he moved to Michigan, he set up at University of Michigan and for a couple of years and then moved to Michigan State, set up the section of the college called Police Community Relations, and then left the college and became deputy director of the Department of Corrections, which is basically the correctional facilities, entire correctional system, and was chairman of the parole board for as long as I can remember.
Yeah.
My mother she graduated, I think she had an associate's 2 years of college, spent the majority of my upbringing at home, but when I was in high school, when I was the youngest, she worked as a librarian for the local county library system.
Uh-huh.
I guess the influence probably goes primarily on my father's side. I remember when I was very young, people would see strange people from different cultures come driving down the road, and they just point, last house on the left, and they were always coming to our house.
Yeah.
So I had quite a background of people from Africa, Asia, Europe, all over the world, coming into the house quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. That's good for a kid.
Yeah, it is. It's very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was, what was I, 10th grade, something like that. I picked up the phone one time and people just are, you nigger loving, blah, 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 blah.
Oh.
And I had realized that my father was working on the Equal Housing Committee in the local community. And then there was this friend of mine whose father found out that we were doing that, and I was forbidden to come over to their houses, a couple friends. So there were always, it was a small community right outside of East Lansing that had not yet, you know, the high school graduated 80 kids when I graduated. I was the only kid out of 12 that went to college that went out of state to college. So it was a very small community mm-hmm. at the time. I ended up picking Earlham because my mother was a librarian and she and my father thought about it. And they sent me on a tour to Kalamazoo College, Antioch, Earlham, and some other smaller college. And I just, my experience at Earlham was such that, you know, you're there for a weekend.
Yeah.
And the experience was such that I knew that's where I wanted to go.
Yeah.
So.
Sometimes students just, or young high school kids just connect with a place.
Yeah, that's what happened. My brothers and sisters went to the higher class school. They changed to the high school and went over to the East Lansing, which was where Michigan State was. It was a much better school. And for some reason, my parents decided to keep me in the same school. I went to the same school system from kindergarten through 12th grade.
Uh-huh.
And was, you know, I played football, basketball, did all the normal things. Was in the top 10 of the class, all of those sorts of things. But, you know, somewhere in my background, my parents had friends from different cultures, vastly different economic backgrounds. They were not very exclusive in terms of their social parameters. They were very broad. And I think that my experience of going to Earlham and then in Earlham itself, the influence of the Quakers, a lot of the students there went overseas. We had very well organized protests against the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
I started out, first I applied to, when I got done, I said, well, what am I going to do? And now that I'm graduating, you know, this has been fun, but I guess I got to do something.
Well,
go ahead.
Pause just a second, though. When you said students went overseas, that's for study abroad sorts of things?
Yeah.
Yeah,
right.
Okay.
And in general, too. I mean, a lot of the students there had spent time overseas in high school, etc. They were, a lot of them were from Quaker boarding schools, private schools in New York City, those kinds of things.
Uh-huh.
That's the first time that I've been influenced by people. I mean, my parents came from New York, from Albany,
uh-huh.
and they transplanted out here after the war.
Uh-huh.
So I'd spent a lot of time out east, going back and forth to my uncle's cabin and stuff, but, you know, that was sort of to your uncle's house.
Yeah, right.
So it was... when I went to school, I was amazed that these kids my own age had been places and read things. I mean, they knew things that I didn't even, I had no idea. And, you know, they'd read all these books that, I mean, I went to a school of, you know, graduating class of 80. Come on. And my first term, after my first term, they put me on academic probation. And I ended up with an extremely good college record, but it was a rude awakening to have to deal with. I guess I thought
tough standards, huh?
Yeah, much tougher, and those people had a much broader background than I did. they had a lot more ability to go to different schools and go overseas. So that was quite a shock originally. But they couldn't fix a car. They didn't know how to put up hay, you know, things like that. When something broke, they didn't know how to fix it. So we were kind of, you know, you kind of got on equal terms after a while.
How'd you learn how to do the hay?
All the neighbors across the street had a farm, had 80 acres, and I used to help them.
Okay.
Then after they got too old, a beatnik bought it, and I helped him build a ocean liner, an ocean-going handmade sailboat in the barn. That was,
mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I had a pretty good background.
Yeah.
That way, I just...
But a real beatnik.
Yeah, this guy was a real beatnik. Oh, yeah.
He was. This is a real Kerouac type.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Peter, Paul, and Mary used to stay at his house when they'd come to East Lansing and sing.
Oh, no kidding.
So I used to go over and hang out at his place. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
But...
I think you're underrating your experiences. Well, I never hung out with Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Well, it happened that he knew him, and I lived across the street. I mean... And I thought, you know, this is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And my sister was into that, so, you know, she used to go over there, too, and she used to let me tag along. So, you know, we used to go to these poetry readings and all that weird stuff. You know, when you're 12, 13, 14 years old, you're pretty impressionable. But Earlham was a really good experience, no doubt about it. Very open. So when I got done, I thought, well, you know, I want to go into Peace Corps. That was... You know, everyone went to Peace Corps. That was Kennedy-esque, you know.
So you were graduating in what, 68?
67.
67.
67.
Okay.
So I got, the Peace Corps accepted me to Chile. I believe it was Chile. And there was a bunch of things going on with copper mines then and stuff. And a couple volunteers got killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I really had this thing about Southeast Asia anyway, so I asked them to change, and they said, okay, we'll change to send you to Malaysia. Well, I was anti-war. And I heard that when you're in Malaysia, they give everyone Hondas to drive around. And I thought, well, I'm going to a third world country. They're not going to give me a Honda. I'm not going to be above everyone else. You know, that sounds kind of... bourgeois to me, so I told him, no, I'm not going to do that. So I started, then I guess I decided I was a conscientious objector. I'm not sure if it was political or, it was probably more political than anything.
Okay.
But it wasn't advisable to tell them you were politically against the war. So I applied the conscientious objector status, and I had... a man who was a friend of my father's and became a very close friend of mine. He was a Fulbright colonel in the Pentagon in the Air Force, and he was the Southeast Asian desk.
Mm-hmm.
And then my roommate's father, who was an Episcopal priest and was a man of great stature, just phenomenal man, was the first person to stand up against Joseph McCarthy in the hearings and was summarily blackballed because he did that.
Yeah.
But was picked up by the Eastern establishment and was given the opportunity to buy land on Cape Cod. In fact, he was the first black man to own property on Cape Cod.
Uh-huh.
And it was because of his going against McCarthy.
Uh-huh.
And a bunch of the Eastern liberals liked him. But he was, I mean, it was legitimate. He was well worth being liked.
Yeah.
But so I had them write letters, and I walked into the draft board, just petrified that they were going to turn me down. And I was the first CO that had come forward in front of them in Lansing, Michigan, in the Vietnam era. And I also had the one conscientious objector from Lansing who had gone against the Second World War. He wrote a letter on my behalf, too.
Oh, okay.
So I had, and he was well known in the community. So I had him as a lawyer. I had a priest, and I had Pentagon stationery. They looked at him. They looked at the Pentagon stationery, you know, and he said, I don't agree with anything that Phil's doing, but I you know, I admire him for his conviction, and I know he's being honest about it, you know. And then they saw, you're asking to go to Vietnam. And they said, you know, no contest, you know, see you later.
Yeah.
If you're going to do that, if you're stupid enough to do that, go right ahead, you have our blessing.
So the fact that you were going into IVS, wanted to go to Vietnam, was a huge factor in your...
Oh, absolutely.
In their decision.
Yep. They thought if somebody was against the war,
mm-hmm.
had all of this documentation, and mm-hmm. was going to Vietnam, they've got to be...
So
something's
got
to be wrong.
So maybe all these letters, even the Pentagon stationery and the former CO from World War II, that kind of was secondary, maybe.
I really think so. I mean, I was prepared. I mean, I put my heart and soul into it. I mean,
uh-huh.
it was a statement of adulthood, of being, of my political position, of my social position, of what I felt was an appropriate response in my lifetime.
Yeah.
It was sort of, and Vietnam was like this too. It's very interesting. It was sort of like a statement like the Spanish Civil War,
uh-huh.
in many ways, in a lot of ways. In fact, I spent a number of times thinking about that in Vietnam with various people. One friend of mine from Earlham was there, and his mother was the secretary...
In IVS?
Yeah. No, he was with American Friends.
Okay. Oh, yes, you mentioned his name.
His mother was the secretary to the Communist Party
uh-huh.
in New York City.
Uh-huh.
And her uncle was in the Spanish Civil War. And then I got to know both of John Steinbeck's sons when I was in Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And of course, he was involved in the Spanish Civil War.
Uh huh.
And we were all sitting around one night talking just about that. And it was very true. There was a, and I don't know if this is a correct word, but there was like a cadre of people that were, in many ways, reliving that kind of a political statement and cultural statement that had occurred
for their fathers.
Yes. Very interesting.
Uh huh. But before you go on,
okay,
and I hope I'm not cutting off some good thought, because I saw you drawing a breath.
Yeah.
But I'm interested in how you got to the conscientious objector decision. You know, I know that it's important for all the reasons that you said.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, because you said that you were interested in Southeast Asia.
Yes.
You were in some. There were protests going on campus.
Right. Well, all over the country.
Well, know. But on your campus.
And, you know.
Yeah, but specific to you.
Okay.
On your campus.
Right.
And your campus is also a Quaker school.
Right.
So, how do those factor in? Is one more important than another, or?
No, I don't think so. I think it was a, you know, and I don't want to sound whatever. It's like a, sounds kind of warm fuzzy, but it was. There was like a collage of these things occurring at this time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they hit you at different times with different intensity, and they sort of built on each other.
Because you would have known Quakers at the school.
Oh, yeah.
Who might have at one time or another discussed their philosophy, and you learned about...
Oh, sure, all the time. I mean,
yeah.
That was part of the experience of Earlham. It was a community-based mm-hmm. school. You did things together. The school would have discussions on various topics and individual books where the whole school had to participate on each semester.
Uh-huh.
And so we'd read we read Fire on Ice, for example. That's one that comes to my mind.
Okay.
And you had to read it.
That's Eldridge Cleaver's.
No, that's James Baldwin.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I was thinking of something else. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, Fire and Ice was just James Baldwin, right.
So we had to read that. The whole
yeah.
school had to read it. And
mm-hmm.
then you had to participate in a school-wide forum that went on over a few days.
Uh-huh.
And so it was, and we also had other topics on the Vietnam War, a similar type of thing. So you shared these kinds of experiences. I went to a lot of protest marches in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
as well. The Quakers have a tradition of service
uh-huh.
to your fellow man.
Yep.
And that was part of that tradition. My parents taught me to trust a person for what they say and what they do, and don't ever judge them based on their social status.
Yeah.
Always be objective. The Vietnam War consumed people of that generation. I mean, mm-hmm. there was no way you couldn't be in between. It was impossible. And it was a political statement to go and be an active participant in opposition to the military effort. And that was why I did it.
Were your parents supportive?
Yes. They didn't agree with it. Mm-hmm. They didn't like me going to a war zone.
Well, I meant with the CO status.
But they were, you know, my father told me, he says, I'm from the military. I believe that one should serve one's country. And I said, well, I am serving my country. It just happens to be in a different capacity.
Yeah.
But I'm still part of Selective Service. I'm still fulfilling my obligations. And he had nothing more to say in reality. I mean, I was going no matter what he said. I mean, it wasn't an issue. But he was, you know, he accepted it, and we've never had a word in opposition to what either one of us did about it. There's mm-hmm. never been anything like it.
Well, I was just thinking that's pretty open-minded mm-hmm. for your father to do, because I think a lot of military fathers would get really upset with their sons.
Yeah, no, he wasn't. He was much more objective. You know, I remember he'd come home at nights, and when he was with the parole board, and he'd be so upset because the other members of the parole board wanted to proceed with business, even to decide on a case, even though the individual that was up for parole didn't have a lawyer present or something. You know, he always used to fight the battle of the underdog. I always remember that. He was extremely open-minded about those sorts of things.
Okay. What would you have done if the draft board said no? That's a little bit beyond where we're going with the study. It just comes to mind. Of course, you never know until it happens. But
right, you never know until it happens. I thought about that and didn't know what to respond. I don't think I would have. I think I probably would have gone into the. I would have been a CO within the military.
Okay.
Some of the medical work and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Although I hate that. I can't stand
it. The non-combatant sort of.
Yeah, I might have. Yeah, non-combatant status. I guess if I'd have been forced into that position. But I will tell you, you know, I spent days writing my response, weeks. My father and my mother are both well-educated. And my father was a lawyer.
Uh-huh.
He taught me how to win an argument
uh-huh.
just by my upbringing.
Uh-huh.
And so when I went in there, I calculated. I mean, I knew. I mean, I wasn't stupid. Uh-huh. I knew that the Pentagon stationery was going to carry a tremendous amount of weight.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And so I put them into, I made sure that I put them in a position. I mean, if they had said no, I would have gone, and my father agreed, and his friend who was a lawyer, who happened to be the CO from World War II that wrote my letter, was my parents' lawyer.
Yeah.
Both he and I agreed in advance that if they did not accept us, that we were going to take this as far as we had to take it. So the reality was, I probably would not have done anything but fight the decision.
Yeah.
And they knew that.
Yeah, and that your father is supporting you in that decision to that extent.
He was known in the community. Mm-hmm. He was known by some of the parole board members as his position, or not parole board, but the Selective Service Board.
Same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Duh. That was no Freudian slip either. So, I mean, when I think back on it, I mean, I put a lot into it, but I think I knew when I walked in there that I had what I wanted.
Uh-huh.
I was just surprised at the ease at which it came.
Yeah. Okay.
That's how I got to that point.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's good. Yeah.
If you want any clarification, add, but that's about all I...
No, that was the clarification that I was just curious. I'm almost more personal than for the project, I mean, per se, that I'm doing now. But.
Yeah, couldn't I knew that you had various levels of appeal.
Yeah.
And the lawyer here in town that was the CO in World War II, you know, he had to go through pure hell to get what he wanted. And his was not so much a political statement as it was a religious statement. I mean, he was clearly a conscientious objector on religious grounds. I mean, there was no...
What was his religion?
I have no idea.
Okay. Come to think of it, what was your family's religion?
Episcopalian.
Okay.
And they were, they participated in the church an awful lot. And they were very, and my father was a deacon. My mother was a deaconess, if they had such things at that time.
For your mom?
She was a deacon as well. It's just, it wasn't quite the same back then.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you find out about IVS, per se?
Through Earlham.
Through Earlham?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Kind of a... career counseling sort of thing? And
no, just talking with lots of different people about alternatives, going with the friends. I didn't want to go with the friends as much. I wanted to go, I learned about IVS and talked to some people who had been at IVS and felt that was it was easier. I mean, I wasn't Quaker. I went to school, and they were very selective in who they took.
Uh-huh.
And I felt I had a better opportunity to go with IVS.
So opportunity was the reason?
Primarily, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there were more volunteers. They were, I think, at that time, my roommate went with American Friends Service Committee, but I think they had like 15 people, 20 people that they took that year.
And nationwide?
Yeah. And IVS, we had 30 or something like that. So uh-huh. There was... Or maybe it was greater. I don't know. But, I mean, I...
The numbers were there.
The numbers were there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was, I didn't know that much about it. I knew it was You Save Money.
Uh-huh. Many people didn't.
I knew that right from the get-go. And that bothered me a little bit.
Uh-huh.
But in talking to some people that were IVS volunteers, it seemed to me that it was... liberal enough to allow freedom of expression.
Uh-huh.
So I said, okay.
Yeah. Some other folks from your college also went to IVS about the same time.
Yeah, I said Dick Berliner. He was 1 year ahead of me.
Okay.
So I knew Dick. And I knew Dick's brother. And he was my age.
Uh-huh.
So I found out a little bit about IVS through his brother.
Okay.
And there were other people from, Steve Swift was from Earlham, a couple others.
Uh-huh.
So it was sort of word of mouth within the community, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you weren't going off alone on an adventure. You knew that this was this part of a thing and that other people that you knew and respected
and
were doing the same.
Yeah. And I knew that IVS was... what the Peace Corps was modeled after.
Okay.
And if I was willing to go with the Peace Corps, then You Save Money shouldn't taint it.
It's the same government as Peace Corps.
Yeah.
They both have an eagle on it.
So.
Okay.
That's why I went.
Mm-hmm. So you applied, and what about any application process, interviews, whatever?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I have no recollection whatsoever. The only thing I remember was going to Harper's Ferry.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that, the orientation session.
Do you... still gonna... How much tape we got here? Okay, we're fine.
Okay.
it'll automatically click off, but I just keep an eye on it. Don't want to talk during leaders. Do you remember some of the people who were with you at Harper's Ferry who went to Vietnam? There might have been, at the same time, people in your orientation who were headed towards Laos, but...
I remember a lot of the people that went to Laos.
Rather than Vietnam?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I do remember Hamilton, Jordan, whatever.
Carter's guy.
Yeah. We spent time together there, and then we roomed together in the Philippines. And then I did mention Dick Stern. He was the one that I think I had the most affinity with.
Uh-huh.
He went to Laos. The people from Laos were a little... They were easier to get along with for some reason in Harper's Ferry. They were much more open, and
uh-huh.
we had good times together, and... the people from Vietnam were kind of...
Okay, back on.
And then, let's see, who else was I in there? I was with there with Masafumi Nagao. He was there. I think I remember primarily for a comment that I gave you earlier with what was the man's name? The older gentleman that I was referring to? A.Z.
Oh, A.Z. Gardner.
A.Z. Gardner,
who was director of IBS
at the time, yeah.
Nationwide, or worldwide.
Worldwide, yeah. I remember it primarily for that incident that where he pointed at me in the final hours of the orientation and said, there are some of you in here who should not go because of the issue of, you know, you're saying that it's political and you must go over there with a non-political atmosphere or a perspective. And,
uh-huh.
and I was, as I said earlier, I was vehemently disagreeing with him because the fact that you were an American in Vietnam is a political statement in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you are perceived in such a way, you are perceived because of the politics,
mm-hmm.
and that you ought to recognize that and go over there with an open mind and so that you can at least begin to understand how people are reacting to you and what potential dangers you face socially and otherwise. And
even how you see things.
Right. And I was... if there was anything that I tried to put forth in that orientation was that, to try to help... I don't know if that's right. I might have had a chip on my shoulder, but...
well, you're 21, 22.
Yeah. But the other people were going into it so just, you know, like, this is a Peace Corps to, you know, Argentina. Well, this is not... the Peace Corps. This is not Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
This is a war, and it's political. And if you don't understand that, you may not make it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were just a lot. I think a lot of people who were naive might be a word for them, or maybe just hadn't crossed their consciousness, which is maybe the same thing as naive, but. They didn't want to look at it in that way.
Yeah.
And that, I wanted to look at it in that way, damn it. So that, you know, that's the major thing of Harper's Ferry that I remember.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Harper's Ferry, that was relatively short in terms of
A week?
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. And from there, what happened?
Jumped on a jet plane.
Okay. No and training for language in Washington?
No.
Straight out?
Straight out.
All right.
Went to Los Banos, the college there.
Okay.
Stayed at this really nice little hotel that had a moon. It was called Moon Lake. And in the hotel were hot mineral spas. So we used to jump out into the water and then run back in. It's in the swimming pool. They had a swimming pool.
Uh-huh.
We'd jump in the swimming pool, and it was colder than hell. And then we'd all run into these mineral spas and just sit back and have a ball.
Uh-huh.
It was fun. And we just, we dug around and got leeches on us and tried to corral the water buffaloes and stick rice in the patty and, do normal things that you do on a farm. It's in Southeast Asia. And, there were a lot of ag people, that were into it, really into it, And then there were the English teachers who didn't want anything to do with it. And then there were the community development people that were kind of the liberal fringe of IVS. We were there for, 2 weeks maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And then we packed our bags and went back to Manila. Well, it was actually the night we were packing our bags to leave Los Banos. That's when the word came down that Don Luce and Gene Stolfus, and I think those were the only two, but I can't remember.
No, Ronk and...
Ronk, too.
And Gene Myers, or Willie Myers, excuse me.
Yeah, okay, that was it. They had resigned. And so they were communicating back and forth. And, call off the flight, they're not coming.
They from Saigon were calling Los Banos saying...
your flight's over with, don't even think about it.
Uh-huh.
And we were supposed to leave at 10 o'clock in the morning, and 8 o'clock we were all, are we going back to the States? What's happening? And they finally decided, it's hot over here, but we'll deal with that. You volunteers go off to Laos and come into Vietnam. And we'll get rid of you. And that's what they did. They shipped us off to Tainan to go to language school. We didn't even spend a night in the IVS headquarters.
Uh-huh.
But I do remember getting on that plane. Oh, my God, my heart was just thumping. I was sitting right on the edge of the seat looking out the window, and all of a sudden the Delta land came in view. And I felt like it was such a rush. It was just amazing. It's like I'm here. I've made it.
Aha! Uh-huh. This is it.
This is it. This, and it wasn't because IVS was going down. This was a personal. I'd finally done something and made a statement, and I was going. This was my political and my social statement of my adulthood. All this stuff came rushing. It was just amazing. And then we went from Tatsunut over down to Le Van Zwitt Street and. Put our bags in the thing, and they pulled us in the thing and put in this big room on the second floor and had this 30-minute orientation with Don Luce there and Gene Stolfus, and they were talking to us and telling us what happened. And they said, and now we want you all to pick up your bags and get in the bus down there, and you're going down 30 miles south of here to start your training. We don't want you around. There's issues that you can't understand, and it's nothing to say against you, but it's just there's things that have to be done, and you're in the way.
You don't have the background.
Right, and we didn't.
Uh-huh.
And so then that's when it started.
Did anyone in the group decide that maybe they shouldn't make this commitment because things were so chaotic and packed up and went home?
No.
Everyone
stuck it out.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. I forgot to ask you what your major was in college.
Political science and sociology, and a minor in philosophy.
And you were put into an ag program.
Well, I was put into community development.
Community development? Oh, okay. All right. So even the CD people were in the Los Baños agriculture.
Oh, yeah, everyone had to go there.
That's right, because you mentioned that the English people didn't want to have anything to do with it.
I think the English people went. Maybe they didn't.
Okay.
Maybe it was just ag and CD. I don't remember. I don't know.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. I just assumed that because you went to the Los Baños campus of UP you were shuttled off under a... Oh, now I look at your survey form and it clearly says CD and I haven't done my homework. My screw up. I'm sorry about that. What were some of your impressions when you, those first impressions that everyone has when they come into a new situation? Can you remember some of the first things that struck you about this new land where you're coming to?
It was hot. People were short. The Americans were big and obnoxious. There were people everywhere. There were guns everywhere.
Uh-huh.
And the landscape was gorgeous. I couldn't believe the rice paddies. And I noticed that the villages were all circular and intertwined as a unit. And everything came out from the village.
Uh-huh.
And I could sense a real sense of community.
Uh-huh.
The first night we got there quite late in the afternoon, almost to dark, because they wanted to get us out of Saigon, out of the IVS headquarters.
Okay, so you might have landed early in the morning, but by the afternoon you're on your way.
Oh yeah, we were in the IVS place in a very, very short time out.
Uh-huh.
And so the first night I climbed up on top of the roof of the dormitory we were staying in, and right next to us is the bridge, who a friend of mine was guarding at the time, and I didn't know it. I'm about 20 years later, I found out that he was, I don't know if he was there that night, but mm-hmm. that's where he was stationed.
And Vietnamese in the military?
No, American.
Oh, American.
Yep.
I see. Okay. All right.
So anyway, I got up on top of the roof and watched these flares, I mean, and then the Hueys and the choppers and this line of fire, you know, it's every fifth bullet was a tracer.
Yeah, yeah.
And I stayed up there for like 2 or 3 hours in the middle of the night, bullets going everywhere. A couple hitting the roof. And I was just, you know, I was in ecstasy. And I was had a tape recorder like you've got, and I was just recording everything, and I sent it to, at that time it was a girl that I had been living with before I left.
Uh-huh.
And I just was just in awe of everything. And
uh-huh.
It was amazing. It really was. Then the next day we had young students, young boys and girls, they were college students,
uh-huh.
teaching us Vietnamese.
Uh-huh.
And
by the way, before you say that, did you ever listen to the tape later? I mean, do you ever get it back from this girl
to?
Yeah,
I did.
Uh-huh. To at least take a listen to, if not to take back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I never took it back.
Yeah.
It was, you could tell it was, you know, you were on a high. There was no doubt about it. I mean,
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Wow, look at that. There's bullets going everywhere. That bullet just hit the roof, you know. They've got these lights that make it like day out there, you know. And it's just, you know, it was more descriptive than anything else. And then there were statements like, you know, weird philosophical statements that you're prone to make when you're that age. But
and what did you think about it when you listened to it later?
Because
it would have been maybe 3 years later or something like that.
I thought it was pretty funny.
Uh-huh.
And yet there were parts of it that were very, you know, that was a very, you know, that said it. That one sentence said what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, I jumped on a bike. We were supposed to start class, and I wanted to get out there.
Uh-huh.
And they had said that IVS told us to cut our hair short, you know, and no beards and everything. So I was dutifully American looking. And I jumped on, I borrowed a bike. And they said, yeah, you can go into town. Class starts in an hour or something like that. Well, instead of turning right to go into town, I turned left because I'd seen that one village that was up there close that was all circular, you know, and I, you know, I, I'd had a little anthropology and stuff, and I thought, you know, this is pretty cool. I'm going to go check this out.
Uh-huh.
So I take my bike up, and I get about a half a mile outside of town, and all of a sudden, bullets going across the road from this village, and they're shooting at me. So I just turned the bike. I turned the bike and went right into the rice paddies, just, you know, full up to my neck in rice paddies by the time I got done. And they came out from the bridge and called in the chopper and strafed the village or around it and stuff like that, and sent some troops in there. And then I went back into class. And so that, and from that day forth, I decided I was going to grow a beard and get my hair long.
Mm-hmm.
And not look like an American.
Mm-hmm.
I said, that's not good. And they could, yeah, they could see you coming anyway. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
5 foot
skin color was the tip off.
Yeah.
The physical stature and all that kind of let them know who you were.
So I found out that life can be dangerous very quickly.
Yeah. And it wasn't just sitting up on top of the roof enjoying the show.
Yeah, right.
This is not a movie.
Yeah, I came home very quickly.
Yeah.
Why I wasn't hit, I don't know.
Yeah, well.
I should have been.
Somebody was looking out for you, I guess. You know, fate or karma or
whatever.
You know,
so
you
that
name
was,
it.
That was my first 24 hours.
Uh-huh.
But I had a lot of trouble. With the teachers were very nice, you know.
These college
yeah,
students.
Yeah, they were very nice, you know, and uh-huh. They tried very much, but they would translate it. And I figured you can't learn a language by translating it. You can't go from English to Vietnamese back to English and get anywhere. So I, after about 3 days, I just quit. And they have these kindergarten books in Vietnam. They're called Lup Nam A, or the A book. And Lup Nam Bay, which is the B book.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. It goes through and it goes and it puts together all the consonants. Emma A Ma. Emma Ma Shak Ma. Emma Ma Nang Ma. And it's got the five, you know, Nga Ma. You know, it's got the five ways of saying it.
Mm-hmm. With all the different tones.
With all the different tones. And that's just what the kindergarten kids did. So I got my, still got my bike. I'd jump on my bike or I'd walk, whatever. And I'd take Lup Nam A and Lup Nam Bay, and I'd go downtown at the market, and you know, all the women, yeah, there's American, and all the, but all these little kids, and I knew that I shouldn't be embarrassed, that I should accept the fact that I'm a kid again.
Yeah, okay, that's good.
And so
a lot of people have trouble with languages because they have too much ego involved in stumbling.
I knew. Mm-hmm. I knew that that's what you had to do.
Mm-hmm.
Just instinctively. I don't know why, but I knew. And I remember, you know, I remember saying to myself, don't be afraid to screw up, you know, because the only... And I just immersed myself totally. And so I would go to the market every day, and these kids would come up to me after, you know, and they'd everyone help, and the women would help. And I, as I was saying earlier, I really like to cook.
Yes.
And so I went into the kitchen.
Even if it's a simple meal,
yeah.
It still turns out great.
The place where we had, there was a couple that they had extra rooms and they rented out to IDS. And then there was a Buddhist place down the way that we went and tried to learn Vietnamese. Well, they would cook every day for us.
Uh-huh.
So I'd go in and after a couple of days, I said, well, can I help in the kitchen? No, we don't want a big old fat American in here. Stay out of here. I said, okay. Can I sweep up? You want to sweep up? I said, yeah. It's okay. So let me sweep up. And then they had a hog to butcher. Well, I'd butchered lots of hogs in my day, so I knew what to do. I said, well, can I help with that? Then I started showing them what I knew. I said, oh, look at this guy. He knows what he's doing. And so then I said, well, can I, then after that, can I cut vegetables?
Mm-hmm.
And so it got to the point after about where, however long we were there, a month maybe, where I was in there preparing meals with them. And I used to go to the market all the time, and I figured out, you know, all the different fruits and vegetables, and I picked it up that way, by interacting with people on a one-to-one basis, doing something practical,
uh-huh.
Rather than trying to, you know, good afternoon.
Go through drills and...
Good afternoon, Mr. Scott. How are you today? Well,
yeah.
You know, I mean, come on. So, both myself and Masafumi, he picked up Vietnamese very quickly, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but he knew Chinese characters, obviously.
Uh-huh.
Japanese. So he used to go down and hang out at the
at the local chess game with all the old men and started talking to them right away with all these characters. And so he picked up Vietnamese that way.
Uh-huh.
So he did it in a very practical sense, and so did I. And it was much easier to learn the language.
This is not about you, but about him and your observation of him.
Mm-hmm.
Did he have problems in Vietnam because he was Japanese?
You know, I only spent time with him during the language training.
Okay.
Not
much time to observe.
No. And I mean, the Vietnamese are deeply prejudiced people.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about it. I mean, they'll hold the prejudice longer than white America almost. But
that's a long time.
Yeah, that is. But, well, they hate the Chinese. You know, what can you say?
But
they hate the Japanese,
and
too.
And the Japanese, too, because of the Second World War.
But
I would assume.
Yeah. But the Vietnamese also, if they see you as an individual making the transition,
uh-huh.
then they're willing to deal with you as an individual.
Okay.
And not hold your background against you so much. And I think anyone who is a foreigner that is an interloper between cultures,
yeah,
has a lot more freedom than someone else. Be that a Vietnamese or a person who's Japanese who's not willing to give up on the fact that they're Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
Your willingness to, and there's a uniqueness about you that they can see too, that you are one of those people who can make that transition, and they saw that in him.
Uh huh. Okay. Something that you just said reminded me of a saying that I'm going to pause for the tape because it
okay.
doesn't have anything to do with this.
Okay.
But I think you'll enjoy it. Back to business here.
Okay.
I turned it back on again, so it's running. So you had a very good approach to the language. I suppose I know that you've picked it up very well.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we'll get more into your post-IVS life, but... could you comment a little bit on the value of your language abilities or skills, let's say proficiency level, for your work relationships as opposed to other people who are not quite as skilled, particularly AID and the American community and perhaps other volunteers?
Well, I think it was language proficiency and a perspective on life as well. I think I commented earlier, you know, my father told me to be objective and judge people as to who they are, but not what
uh-huh.
their outside trappings were. And I took that perspective with me with language. There were some volunteers there, and in fact, there was a guy I had dinner with the other day. It was in the... was in Vietnam in the military and went to language school in California, wherever they had it, you know.
Uh-huh.
And this guy knows words that just blow me away. I mean, he can take a Vietnamese literature book and read the whole damn thing and understand every word in it. You give me that book and I won't be able to get past the second word. I
uh-huh.
can't do it. If I can communicate with someone, then I'm in hog heaven. That's, for me, that's communication. I'm not good at book learning.
Uh-huh.
I don't enjoy it. It doesn't give me any direct feedback. A lot of the volunteers, we had experiences that you just can't imagine. One time in particular, I was telling you earlier about going to visit John there in the Wahao country. Minnick and I did that.
And that was John Llewellyn?
John, what's his name, from New York. I saw
Amoroso?
Yeah, Amoroso,
okay.
Yes.
Ah, that's right, yes, of course, okay.
Well, Minnick and I took a trip from Long Xuyen
uh-huh.
and went in there. Or we actually from, where was he? He was in Canta. Uh-huh. And we went from Canton to Longsuin province to go visit John. And we were tired in the afternoon, and so we just kind of walked in and sat down at this restaurant and in the middle of nowhere, you know, just after a crossing where we took the moped across the stream on a little boat. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And we stopped, let's eat, you know. So we walked in, and this old guy and his wife were running. Not that old, but I mean, we were 20, they were probably 35 or 40. So.
Yeah, dinosaurs.
Right. And we just came in and sat down, and this guy looked at us, and he knew. We didn't say a word to anybody. We had not said a word at all. We just sat down, and he knew immediately that we were out of the ordinary visitors.
Uh-huh.
Not just Americans, you know. But he knew we spoke Vietnamese. He just knew it. And he sent his two young 14-year-old daughters out to wait on us.
Uh-huh.
Because they have never had this experience before. And this...
I mean, we went through this entire meal with him and his wife orchestrating this and pushing these girls out here and us saying the appropriate things to make them giggle, you know, to put them a little bit ill at ease and let them come back, you know, so that they understood the social dynamics. And
we got done and paid him, and he said, we left some money, and he didn't want it or something like that, because he and his children had gotten as much out of that meal as we had.
Uh-huh.
And he purposely did it that way. And I don't think, you know, Bob's Vietnamese was good, but it was, I think mine was technically maybe a little bit better. But Bob had this same kind of ability to communicate with people.
Uh-huh.
From a technical perspective, his Vietnamese was okay. But he had a warmth about him, an ease about him, that people just could, you know, you could just talk to him.
Down to today.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's one of, I don't know how many experiences. I remember one time that
Bob and I and Herb Gross, we went to the Saigon Zoo one day in Saigon. I probably shouldn't say this, but we were stoned out of our minds. We were sitting on this little bench, kind of tucked back, and there were three of us eating ice cream, just having a ball. And all of a sudden, an American sergeant walked by with a Vietnamese woman in a red ao dai, with her face done up. You know, I mean, it was clear what the relationship was. And the three of us all at once says, oh shit, we have to have Americans in here.
And we had forgotten, we were so blended in our psyche,
uh-huh.
and where we were sitting off to the corner, and what we were doing, we were eating Vietnamese ice cream, and we were just spending a nice, we were having a ball,
uh-huh.
just walking around the zoo saying hi to people. We felt more comfortable with and amongst the Vietnamese than we did outside of that realm. And I don't think you can, I don't know how you replace that. You have to make that transition. I used to, I woke up one morning at the NVS camp one time. I remember I'd been there about a year or so, in Vietnam about a year. And one of my roommates, because we slept communally in this one place, she said, you were talking in your sleep last night. She said, you had one heck of a dream last night. You were saying blah, 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 blah. And so we were eating breakfast, and all of a sudden it dawned on me. How did she know what I was saying? I still was part American. And then I realized that I had been dreaming. I've been talking in my sleep in Vietnamese.
Uh-huh.
That's pretty far gone. I mean, I'm gone.
Yeah, yeah, deep into things.
Yeah, real deep. And I'm not, you know, my Vietnamese is not technically that good. But I'd crossed over.
Yeah.
I had crossed over, and I don't think. And I lived exclusively with Vietnamese. I never lived with any other Americans. I did that on purpose.
Uh-huh.
I lived by myself for a while when I first got in country, because I was in On K and I didn't know what I was going to do yet. And the NVS place was there, but I didn't have a place to stay.
Uh-huh.
They had an American volunteer there, a woman who was a Quaker. And so I lived in town at the fringes of the prostitute district and worked with the prostitutes.
Uh-huh.
And that lasted about a month, and then that woman from Friends left, and so the NVS invited me over there. So almost exclusively I lived with Vietnamese. So, uh-huh. I mean...
I think that's rare even for other IVSers. I mean, most seem to have at least one IVS.
Or live by themselves.
Or live by themselves,
a lot
perhaps.
Of the teachers lived with... jointly. A lot of the community development people all live by themselves.
Uh-huh.
My experience.
Yeah.
They saw my good points and my bad points, you know. I saw theirs. I was part of their group. Although, in On K, there was when I came in, they said there's a couple things you cannot do, and if you can't agree to them, you can't stay here.
Uh-huh. What were they?
There's a certain village down the road that is between us and the Free Fire Zone. It's a Chu Hoi village, which was the people. Chu Hoi means, I'm not sure what it means in English, but it basically means the people who were former Viet Cong who came over to the government side.
Right.
Okay, and basically it was women and children. There are a few men, but basically women and children. They said, you can never go into that village.
Uh-huh.
And when we go, you cannot come with us.
Do you know why?
Yeah, sure, I know why.
Which was?
Well, that was... That Chu Hoi village was on both sides. They needed to protect their integrity as Vietnamese.
Uh-huh.
And the trust that those people had. And the minute they brought in an American, that trust was shattered. I mean, it's... No matter what I did.
Yeah.
Okay?
So there was a limit. You couldn't go.
I could not do that under any circumstances. They didn't want me to ever go in that village. They didn't care if people knew I lived with them, but they didn't ever... I couldn't go in the village with them, period. And I couldn't go in the village by myself, either. I was not allowed.
Yeah.
And the other thing was, I was never to sleep with a Vietnamese woman while I lived there. That was absolutely out of the question.
You mean with one of them or any Vietnamese woman?
Well, one of them, that's okay.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, I mean, we were a group.
Uh-huh.
So that wasn't an issue.
Uh-huh.
But I wasn't to hang out with Vietnamese women or prostitutes... or even regular women in the social...